The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions. Unfiltered
opinions. I'm Jimmy Moya.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to yet another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed for your viewing and listening pleasure every Monday morning, with the rest of the show set to follow later in the week, of course. This week, we are taking a look at U.S. earnings data. We're taking a look at potentially some of the outperforming stocks in the form of local resource counters, as well as what we can expect for the rest of the week from a markets perspective. In our deep dive, we are going to take a look at how to potentially bolster the South African economy through various creative and alternative methods. We have explored some of these in the past, but we're going to do a bit of an in-depth dive into perhaps some of the things that would work for the South African economy that are within the control of the South African government and other stakeholders. And then in our investor insights, we're going to continue taking a look at some really bizarre developments. Last week, we took a look at the Evergreen contract, the Evergreen contract that came out from the team at Killarney Country Club. This week, we're going to take a look at ghost contracts within government municipalities. A government department agreeing to pay, I think it was around R1 billion, to a company for a lease agreement that doesn't make sense. That's what we're going to get into the show. And of course, there's an unfiltered opinion at the end of the show, so stick around for that. Before we get into the show, the Irish names continue. This week, we are getting close to wrapping up the Irish segment of our name challenge, but we have got new names nevertheless. Si, would you like to go first?
Niamh.
N-I-A-M-H. Niamh.
I'm never going to win this thing.
Okay. I've got F-I-A-D-H.
Fieve.
Close. Very close. Fear. We keep trying. The names are out there. I mean, it is quite an interesting thing. Guys, if you have those names that you'd like us to try out after we're done with our Irish series, let us know. It seems the Irish ones are the hardest ones that we found. If you have found harder ones out there, let's give them a shot. Let's see where we end up with them. Morning to our communities. Morning to those joining us on live stream. Shout out to our TikTok community. Always happy to have you guys on board. Rory says good morning in our live chat. Hopefully he's in his lectures as always. We don't want to encourage bad behavior. Here for good behavior. So let's get straight into market. Actually, before we get into market matters, so part of our deep dive is going to be something that was sparked by the conversations that we put out last week. We spoke about the Evergreen contract with Killarney, but we also spoke about funding Formula One. And over the last couple of weeks, this has stirred up quite a bit of drama online. And I want to get through some of the comments of what we got from
you read the posts. The comments.
Yes, the posts that we put up. I'll read the comments because they're quite interesting. I mean, the lease conversation, for example, the Evergreen contract with Killarney, that garnered quite a bit of reaction, both good and bad. And I suppose it's part of why our deep dive makes so much sense for today's episode. But some of the comments that stood out there, I mean, someone brought up other things and said, well, you see, because of these contracts, it's the reason we're not going forward. We're not having things work out the way they're supposed to. There was a whole hubbub about it. And I just thought I'd pick out some of the interesting comments. I've just jumped into our chat here. And they say, Willie says, Paragon golf course lease is about R904 per year on 55 hectares, if he remembers correctly.
Now, I'm going to prepare to offer $1,500 for that. I mean, I'm not interested in the golf course part, but we could make a little camping setup. I don't know. I mean, like, I could sublet. Yeah, okay.
someone whose handle is Jacob Zuma, I highly doubt it is the leader of the MK party, says, my dad told me that the government complex in Mbombela is on a 100-year lease, a government property. The public is not privy to this information.
Now, there's 100-year leases. I mean, they've got historic precedent. They make some sense. It's not the duration necessarily. It's what are they paying?
That's what we stress, right?
Like, how much are you paying for your 100 years?
Aslam says, what's different than paying 59,000 rand for a pen post-apartheid?
Well, you know, this is not one side's better than the other. This is like oaks are ripping.
So this is why we're going to get into some creative ways to unlock South Africa's economy. We're going to look at things like evergreen contracts in our deep dive and perhaps see if there might be some merit, because there was some merit in some of the comments that were put out. I mean, some of the comments were saying that because these sorts of businesses like Kilani employ people and all of that and contribute towards the economy, we shouldn't be so hard on them around whether or not they're paying for those leases or what amounts they're paying for the leases, because they're creating jobs. That's neither here nor there. That's something we can revisit at another time as to whether or not we agree that it's fair for a company to pay 2 rand for a lease agreement on the simple basis of the fact that they're creating jobs. But that's for the deep dive. Stick around for that. Market matters this week. Earnings in the US continue to come out.
Yeah.
And that's
almost done.
Yeah, we're almost about done. We've gotten the big ones out of the way by and large.
Except Nvidia.
And that's really what wraps up earnings season and gives a lot of guidance to the market. But I did see that from a US-China perspective, they are even more relaxed around those chip prices, saying that the chip deals and the import tariffs and all those sorts of things. It looks as though the US is still very open to having those concessional agreements with China related to the chips as it benefits them.
Yeah, and then this morning, Nvidia and is it AMD can sell chips to China as long as they kick back 15%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's...
Okay.
It's the contracts, right?
We live in times, is I think what you're saying.
That's it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So living in those times, I'm actually trying to find it now. It is on... I saved it from one of my socials. And it is a breakdown, well, not really a comprehensive breakdown, but more of an indication of just how much Trump's net worth has moved over the last... or since stepping into the White House for the second time. It's very interesting. I'm trying to find the exact post. I think I found it. I have found it. So the first 100 days is what is being looked at here. And it is a Northwest University professor and serial entrepreneur named Scott Galloway, put this out on his social pages, saying that the first 100 days of the Trump...
I know Scott Galloway. Well, I mean, don't know him. But, you know of him.
Mm. So he's put out that just some data points from there. Trump-affiliated entities have made $300 million in trading fees in this time. Trump family net worth has increased by about $3 billion US dollars in that time. And we're not accounting for some of the movements from the Trump coin as well and all those other things. But Trump's family net worth has actually gone up significantly in the first 100 days of returning to office. And for some reason, we're still not calling this insider trading.
No, because it's, I mean, insider trading is like when you're doing it in like dark rooms on Signal apps. And, okay, that's a bad example. But, you know, insider trading is usually like, you know, undercover done in a golf course with secret notes and pigeons. This is just like the Oak standing there in White House lawn.
So what's market manipulation out in the open? Yeah, what do we call that?
Just, then it's just Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, to be fair, makes sense. But it has been driving a lot of the movements from a market's perspective. If you look at markets reaching all-time highs, we look at something like the NASDAQ reaching all-time highs last week, our own local markets having traded above 100,000 points. I think we are still above 100,000 points at this stage.
We're now so far above 100,000, although let's be clear when I say so far, I mean things are relative. We're so far above 100,000 that even when we are down 0.04%, we're still above 100,000.
Okay, so we're doing well. Local markets have all but shrugged off kind of the 30% levels. We knew they were coming, right? So I think the market was also just like, okay, cool, if South Africa's in at 30%, then that is what it is, and that's where we're gonna kind of move forward. But the rand has strengthened on the back of that. Back at, I think it was 1770 last week when I checked. I'll take a look at it.
74 right now.
Below 1775 after having touched 1840 when the tariff implementation was coming into effect. So markets pretty much being like, okay, cool. So we're moving on.
Yeah. No, markets totally are. And if we look at S&P earnings, I mean, about 90% have reported. About 81% gave earnings and revenue surprises. In other words, more than was expected. Now, that's just called managing expectations. Let's not get too excited. But earnings growth as we sit right now, and mostly apart from Nvidia, it's the small stocks to come. NVIDIA, of course, is the elephant. Earnings growth has been like almost 12%, which is actually not bad. It's also the third quarter in a row where you've had double-digit earnings growth. This was a good earnings season. Forward PEs gone up to 22.1. Five-year average is about 20 and 10-year average about 18.5. So earnings were good. Market is not cheap and just off highs. I mean, the market is, if it wasn't for all of the tariff shenanigans and wars and other sort of things out there, you would say, market's a little bit expensive, but what's the worry? You know, there's some underpin of earnings. It's just all of that sort of stuff that's now lurking out there. Mm. Tariffs, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, how's that going to potentially impact it? And so earnings were good. Market is responding and ignoring the orange one.
Somehow, I don't think that's going to be something that he would want to hear. I don't think he would want to hear that the world is ignoring him. But there is only so much that the market can take, right? In the form of notes and announcements and demands from the White House. I mean, you can't expect the market to then listen and price in absolutely everything that you say. And if this is going to be you in the first 100 to 200 days of your presidency, then the market has already hit exhaustion. They're not going to keep going through this. But Bitcoin is back above $120,000.
Risk on trade. Yeah. I mean, Bitcoin is your ultimate risk on. I mean, basically, it's a geared option on the S&P 500. It just gets accelerated. So yeah, it's a risk on trade. And it's saying like, you know, don't mind me. The VIX is down at 16, which is sort of like where it goes when it likes to be lazy. Mm. This is a market that is almost, it's kind of just ignoring Trump. It's just like, meh, dude, whatevs. And if you think back to what happened in April and Liberation Day and all the panic around that, just like, yeah, okay, that's fine. We're not going to stress it, which is, let's be clear, is wild.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely
it's totally
crazy.
Wild. Yeah, yeah. But this is how we're rolling.
Mm-hmm. The dollar index as well, going to about 95.90 in terms of lows recently, but seemingly bouncing, hasn't been able to break back above that 110 level, or really above 100, if we're being honest. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I mean, since we've dipped below 100, we haven't broken back and closed above 100 on a monthly kind of setup, but it's also the worst kind of, or in the worst territory we've been in all year. I mean, we started the year closer to 110, and it's just been...
Yeah, it absolutely has. And I mean, to your point, when we say we started the year at 110, that was right about when Trump got sworn in. Yep, that week of 13 Jan, it was when it peaked at 110, and it's been one-way traffic since. It did. I mean, it bounced strongly a couple of weeks ago, back above 100, and then sort of just faded again. And at this point, you want to be short dollar and long the other side of that equation. Unless maybe you're Mexican peso or something. Actually, I take that back. I don't know much about Mexican pesos.
How long do you want to be short dollar? Because I saw something online that suggests that if we start to see rate cuts, the perfect time for rate cuts probably might be around next year from a US perspective, because then it gives the markets a lot more room or a lot more gusto into uncharted territory that we're already in. I mean, we're already at all-time highs. We've been at all-time highs for quite some time across various markets, not just local markets. If we start to see the rate cuts come in from next year and you start to see the optimism push back into equities, how much further does that upside rally go? And I want to look at resources as an example. Resource counters locally are up more than 50% for the year to date.
Resi index, Resi 10 is 75% year to date.
So how much further upside do we go into?
So that's the trick. I mean, and I was looking at the Resi, and the Resi is about 60% gold. It's only 10 stocks. So it's about 60% gold, but 15 or 20% platinum. And I throw Sabania into the platinum more than the gold side. Hmm. And then, of course, you've got some Sasol, some BHP, some Anglo. And there's pretty much your Resi 10. I mean, how much higher can it go? So gold counters, surely. I mean, unless gold breaks above the 3,500 and starts another run, which I think it'll do. I just don't know when. I'm not necessarily expecting that anytime soon. And I think that your PGM counters now need to come to the party. Palladium slipped back a bit. But what we're going to start seeing from that index is the dividends come tearing.
Mm. As
the gold miners start paying juicy, juicy dividends. You know, is it going to do 75% in the next year? Look, I've seen crazier, but that would be proper crazy. Mm. But at this point, I think it starts to become a dividend play. The dollar index, I think it can get down to the low 90s.
Really?
Sure.
I can see 90 points, eh?
Yeah.
I can see 90.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can see 85 just yet.
Ooh, no. I mean,
that's a bit too depressed, but I can see 90 also being a new level of support, coming back to retest that level. But then that implies then that the White House and Mussolini over there do something crazy that the market really doesn't like, because up to now, he's done the craziest that he can, and the market hasn't gone that low, so it would require a new level of crazy to be unlocked for us to go down that low.
It absolutely absolutely would. And to be clear, part of the Trump plan, and I use that word cautiously, is a weaker dollar. Mm-hmm. It helps exporters. It makes them more competitive. And if you look at sort of the tech stocks, they, you know, the Mag 6 or however many we left in the mags, a lot of theirs is export. So it merely matters. It doesn't help your Russell 2000, about 20% is export. So it really is more on the tech side, more on the S&P side. He wants a weaker dollar. How much weaker? Time will tell. And we also have to remember that the DXY is dollar index, mostly euro, and it's certainly EMs. DMs. There's no ZARs in there. There's no Turkish liras, Mexican pesos, or Brazilian reals, or anything else. But he's not overly stressed by the weaker currency. How do you pay off a large amount of debt? Deflate it away? One way to do it, or weaken it in currency.
There we go. So you end up paying less effectively. David has jumped onto our live chat and said, what is the best Monday morning live on YouTube? And why is it Insider Exchange?
Because that's how we roll.
That's how we roll. There we go. Welcome, David. Lovely to have you with us. We don't know. Hey, we don't know. I think it's because we have guys like you in our community that always give us a reason to love Mondays a little bit more, because Mondays are not for everybody, right? We've spoken about this. Mondays, oof. But if we have community like we do, we continue to show up and we continue to do the best that we can for the community. So that's why Monday mornings are so great. And that's why this live is probably the best on a Monday morning. Speaking of the live, before we wrap it up, let's get a sense of how the day looks and what markets look like. I mean, I'm looking at the Rand. We said 1773-ish is 1774 is where we are. I think we've got a bit of gusto to come down to 1750. Wouldn't be surprised if we push down to that. I mean, even if we start to move up from here, I don't see us breaching 18 Rand unnecessarily at the moment. All but the worst has been factored in at this point, despite the fact that things like the National Dialogue don't seem to be working out for President Ramaphosa locally. I don't think those sorts of events move the Rand at the moment. I think that's a minor political inconvenience.
And we rushed above, 2 weeks ago, we rushed above 18. We got to a high of 1835, just ahead of the tariffs. And what we see is that when that happened, the market just came and traded it. It was insane. Got to 1835 and then turned on a dime and just went back to 18. Now back at 1770 and some change. The Rand is looking stronger. I agree with you, 1750. 17 is the number I'm really keeping an eye on.
Yeah, so I'm looking at that liquidity sweep that you're talking about, just above the 1840, 1835-ish range. And that for me looks very much like something that if we were to get a couple of things right locally, we could break 1750. Mm-hmm. That is enough momentum for us to, if we start to come and test 1750 again, 17 is not out of the question. It really isn't. Yeah. But for 17 to happen means then that South Africa needs to be doing well. It means then that we need to be having a GDP growth that isn't going to be knocked by...
I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, how much is it rand strength? How much is it dollar weakness? And it's bits of both. I mean, it certainly is bits of both. We all read that Nedbank statement from last week, their forward guidance. They've got Standard Bank on Thursday. Mm. I want to see how bad their forward guidance looks. ABSA, I think, next week, so I think Friday. But it is, at this point in time, certainly, I think we're moving stronger, and I don't see any reason why that's stronger in the rand, higher on our market. Mm. And today we're down, and today it really is all just about resources. If resources weren't counting, we would be up nicely. They're down 2%, our market's flat. I mean, and that is just resources. Stronger rand, because it's now 1772 as we talk. Gold off a bit, and I'm watching palladium. Palladium's looking a little bit,
Yeah, I think there's a lot within the market. I think there's a lot that's going to, I mean, I'm looking at the top 40 now. All-time highs, basically. We broke above the previous high that we had set at 93,000. I think we're at almost at 93,500 at the moment. And from, I mean, if we look at the chart, it's one of those bottom left, top right charts, and looks absolutely fantastic having bounced off 90,000 points. So I do want to believe that there is more upside for all markets, South Africa included. But I think a lot of that, as you said, is a function of some of the other variables, like the market negatively pricing in Orange Mussolini's comments every now and then. But also, I think the performances, like you said, the PGM counters, the gold counters, they're going to start reporting numbers that don't look real because their all-in sustained costs haven't moved.
They've hardly moved. I mean, they were making, I did an analysis earlier in the year for the results to end of December, and some were half year, whatever it was, but they were averaging a gold price of around 2,200. They're now averaging a gold price of 3,300. That extra $1,000 an ounce just drops straight to bottom line. A little bit gets taken off for bonuses and costs, but most of that $1,000 just like shroom, bottom line, paid out as dividends. If they're not paying it out as dividends, careful, because what are they paying it out as?
And where is it going? Yeah, absolutely. I think those are important factors. But we're going to have to leave our market matters on that note. We're going to keep an eye on some things coming out this week. As Si mentioned, we've got an update from Africa's largest bank by assets in in the form of Standard Bank later this week. So we'll be covering that and taking a look at that when we can next week. And just how they are viewing the market, I think it's important because financial stocks in South Africa's context are almost lead indicators of how the strength of the South African economy might be perceived by global markets as well. So as those financial companies continue to report on what they are seeing, we'll see how that continues to affect markets. And we'll keep an eye out for the other things that are developing this week. I believe we've got some US data coming out this week as well, as we usually do. But I think those data points become somewhat important depending on what we see from the White House. Again, that is going to be the driving factor of a lot of these conversations. But this is where we're going to leave market matters. We're going to get into our deep dive. As we said, we're diving into creative ways to reignite the South African economy, taken off the back of things like those evergreen contracts that we've spoken about in the past. So stick around for that, dropping later in the week. But for now, this has been Market Matters. And in our deep dive this week, we are diving into how to unlock South Africa's economy, understanding that we have some challenges that we've been facing, but perhaps there are some interesting and innovative ways that we can approach some of these challenges to see if perhaps we can do a little bit more. We know that this has been something that has come up a lot, and we know that we've spoken about things like a 100 billion rand transformation fund. We know that we've spoken about policies that haven't worked in the past and whether or not some policies have delivered as they have expected to. I think the reason this dive comes up for us is the fact that we've looked at some really interesting and innovative ways to boost some spend and some market activities and all of that sort of stuff. And when we looked at the Formula One thing, we said the Formula One business model can be extremely profitable for everybody. It can have more social benefit, unlock tourism, it can unlock all sorts of other additional benefits there. But often we found that these sorts of initiatives, and this is the challenge again with something like Formula One, require an enabling environment. And we haven't exactly had the most enabling environment from a South African perspective. And perhaps that's it. That's what we're looking at, is how do we have the South African environment be more enabling and more conducive towards people participating. Right? I think a good starting point is something you've mentioned in the past, Sai, is having tax breaks, tax concessions to say, if you operate this kind of business, this is the tax break you get. I mean, when we launched solar panels and we tried to get private use to pivot towards solar solutions, there was 125% tax incentive for the installations and all of that sort of stuff. So tax breaks are a good way to do that, to stimulate people or to actually redirect people into a particular sector or a particular area to work in, but that doesn't solve the problem necessarily. That's one incentive.
That's a good point. And it doesn't solve the problem. It just tries to make the problem a little easier for third parties, i.e. investors and the like, to kind of make it happen. Mm. You still got to make it happen. Mm. And that's the thing.
So how does that happen in South Africa, where things like the construction mafia that supposedly exists out there are being allowed to operate the way they operate without any real recourse, I suppose? Whether there is recourse, whether there isn't, whether some of the claims are legitimate or not, it's a factor you have to contend with. If I am a construction firm, a WBHO or whoever I am, depending on the project, some of the projects I abandon because, or I don't even pitch for because it is too much of a headache to have to deal with, right? So one can't really say that these sorts of things don't affect us. So,
and that boils down to rule of law, which again, you know, there's a few things that you want for an economy to grow. Electricity, nice one. Rule of law is the other. And you talk around a construction mafia. That's just rule of law, surely. I mean, it's like a case of you don't get the right to go to a construction site and demand your 30%. It's like, no, I mean, join the queue and get a job.
So, I mean, I think a lot of the conversation that's happened in South Africa is conversations around redressing things of the past. And that came up again when we were looking at those lease agreements with the likes of Kilani Country Club and all of that. So that is something that is pretty much ingrained in South Africa's DNA. We don't have an equal past and we don't come from an equal past environment. But as we've shown with some of the exercises that we've done, and I think back to the Stokvel conversation that we had on our show, which we'll revisit, folks. Let us know your thoughts around that as well. The Stokvel conversation, to say you can effectively create buying power out of thin air if you have a proper plan and a consolidated or a concerted effort rather to achieving this, right? But then once we have that, this is where the deployment comes in and the implementation side of things, right? So if we are to look at making the South African environment, economically speaking, a bit more attractive, tax concessions is one point there. I think what we can also add to that kind of conversation is perhaps funding and financing. It's important to look at that, because in as much as we talk about, oh, these sorts of initiatives are great, I understand that there's some initiatives that have to have a social benefit, and so it's a social spend, but I feel as though there is not enough that is being put into creating new ventures. Venture capital and unlocking actual business ideas. There are plenty of business ideas out there that, if given a bit of legs, would be able to run. But the unfortunate part is nobody wants to take the risk. The banks don't want to take the risk. The private equity firms and the hedge funds don't want to take the risk. The government says they want to take the risk, but they all end up funding the projects that don't make sense. I mean, how else do we explain that some of the projects that were funded? I mean, I'm looking at, for example, I read something about an IDC project to build boats in Kenya, and the boat company sits in Kenya. They were supposedly going to buy the boat parts from South Africa and then go build these on-water boat resorty thingies in Kenya. The IDC financed that sort of deal to the tune of several millions, and that deal didn't go as planned. And you look at innovations like that and you say, okay, but should we then not be deploying money into South Africa first before looking to deploy into other countries? Now, I get that we can talk about the fact that we need to diversify risk, and South Africa might be a concentration risk for an IDC, but you're an organization that exists in South Africa. Should we not be solving problems at home first?
Yeah, we absolutely should. Look, to be clear, investing in any business carries risk. That's just the nature of business. We're not uncomfortable with that. But I mean, should we be, and I know, for example, that, I mean, the IDC does do some offshore stuff, and I appreciate that. But I do take the point that maybe we should take our risks at home, because if you invest into a venture and it goes bust, okay, you've lost, there has been some auxiliary activity around it. There has been some money spent that then goes into the broader community and economy. I mean, you know, love me some Kenya, but not helping if it's in Kenya. But it is, I mean, to the point, and it's always a case of, it's just chicken and eggs. Banks don't want to fund it until it's provable, and then you don't need the bank, etc. It is really, really hard. And I think there's small things. For example, practically registering a PTY now is literally a 20-minute exercise online, boom, bang, done. That's a huge change and incredibly important. But there are 100 other components that make it very difficult. For example, our VAT threshold remains at $1 million. If you do $1 million revenue, the first month you think you're going to do $1 million in a calendar year, or in a year, I think it's a tax year, you need to register for VAT. It's a pain, but it's been $1 million for, like, I don't know, 15 years. That should be 2.5, 3, 5 million. We should make it easier for those smaller. And again, that's the enabling environment. In this case, it happens to be around legislation, in this case, particularly on when you need to register for VAT.
Speaking of legislation, the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, the DMRE, that's responsible for minerals licenses and mining licenses throughout the country, they came out with a unique proposal to perhaps adjust and amend the legislation that we currently have to incorporate things like artisanal miners more so, and perhaps find licensing for artisanal miners. I spoke to a mining expert around that, Peter Major, and he mentioned...
Yeah, you spoke to the mining expert.
The mining expert. And Peter Major, I asked him his thoughts around that, around whether or not that's a good plan. And he said no. He said mining is an expensive exercise. Why are you trying to encourage small-scale miners that are not going to be able to meaningfully contribute towards the scale of an operation? They're going to mine for themselves. They're going to mine in small bits and batches. They're not going to employ too many people around what they're doing because their businesses are not structured in that way. He said we should be looking at encouraging huge capital investment to come into mining, because the moment you put down hundreds of millions of billions into the mining, then you start to be able to create more jobs, go further into the mining exercise. And we just spoke about the saying that mining is not a cheap endeavor to go into. And I suppose when you look at it from that perspective, the age-old argument that immediately comes up is, but then the resources are extracted and taken out of the country and we don't benefit from them. And again, that's where the beneficiation conversation comes back.
Sure, but that's the beneficiation. I can never say that word. That's where people are making the jury. Whether you're an artisanal miner or a top 40 miner, the point is that you're selling it onto the market and taking the best price you can. Wanting to make the jury local in South Africa is another whole different debate. And it's a debate our government has been having for over 20 years and made very little. I think it's Italy, which exports more gold than we do. They don't mine gold. They bring it in, they make it into stuff, and then they export it.
So we've looked at the direct tax incentives that can come from it. We've looked at the fact that you need regulatory reform in the form of legislation or however it is you want to look at it. But there are some other unique things that we can do. And I want to bring up the evergreen leases, right? Because part of the comments that came out as well, when we discussed the Kalani conversation in the episode that we did, was that places like that create jobs, and therefore you're better off having a Kalani there, even if it is on a low lease agreement, because the auxiliary benefit of the amount of jobs they create and the amount of contributions that they make towards their little ecosystem makes sense. Now, I wonder, can we then apply that sort of thinking to other industries, to other businesses? Eskom already does it with their negotiable contract agreements. I've looked into this on our radio show as well, where they locked into, if I remember correctly, there was a particular smelter owned by South 32, and that smelter business was locked into a preferential agreement, preferential procurement agreement for electricity because of how much they contribute towards the economy. Is that something we could look at from a business perspective and say, if your business employs X amount of people or more, or contributes X amount of rands or more directly to the economy that we can see, whether by way of taxes or whatever it is, then you are then allowed or entitled to sort of preferential contracts in the form of lower lease agreements and all of that, because we have the land, right? So that's another comment that came up with the Kalani thing, is we actually have the land. So use the land. If you can put a business on a piece of land for one rand so that that business actually succeeds and is sustainable, should we not be looking at those kinds of evergreen contracts and those lease agreements that are very flexible for businesses or for sectors that contribute so much?
So yes, I mean, the problem, of course, as we know, is that the cadres are going to come and eat. But aside from that, as a challenge, I don't have a problem with leasing land for one rand. And if the argument is jobs, well, then let's have an open tender, because you and I could go there. I mean, how many jobs could we create if we paid 2 rand and doubled their lease? I mean, that Kalani lease just smacks of, you know, he has a quick little backhand before the laws change.
Mm.
And we see it in places like the economic zones. We've got Kuche, we've got the Durban one, Dube Trade Port in Durban,
mm-hmm.
Just outside Durban by the airport, where you do get special benefits. And if you're the IDZs, if you come here, your tax rate is whatever, etc. We do it. It needs to be carefully regulated because it can go horribly wrong.
Should we do more of those? The IDZs, the industrial development zones? Yeah, I mean, we've countries like, we've got areas like Dubai and the UAE that have
Zhang in China.
That's it. A lot of places around the world have these special economic zones where you can set up a business. It's effortless. It's easy. It's tax friendly. We don't charge you for certain things. We give you all of these concessions because we want you to come and set up the business there because it'll have additional benefits. I mean, should we be doing that for South Africa? And if we do we make it sector specific? What are the key sectors that South Africa needs to grow? We're a mineral intensive country. Perhaps
so
we should be leaning into
back
that.
To that benefication story.
Yes.
Why don't we make a part of, I don't know, Loop Street in Cape Town? If you are a jewelry maker in Loop Street in Cape Town, you get a cut. I mean, something.
You don't pay taxes for a certain period of time.
Yeah. I mean, stuff like that. I mean, I do think, and the thing with the IDZs is people hate them because, like, oh, they call them white elephants. The problem is you've got to build it first.
Mm.
Then they come. And it takes time. And I've been flying into Durban forever. That airport was 2010, I think they built it. 15 years. And you slowly see things starting to happen. It's not an overnight thing. It's a multi-decade thing. But it does work.
Mm. So other things, I'm thinking about the Department of Home Affairs. The Department of Home Affairs obviously launched those visas that you and I spoke about on a separate episode. And those visas, that seems like an incentive in itself to say, if you're a particular country, a company coming to do a particular service in this country, like hosts, meetings, conferences and things, a meets visa, easier to get electronically done, fast-tracked through, so that we can attract that type of business more and more.
And in those visas, so this morning the Business Day was talking about it, and here they're talking tourists.
Yes.
Additional 25,000.
The stages visa.
Yeah, 25,000 extra tourists from India and China who just came and spent money and looked at things and No, and it is things like that. And I mean, 25,000 is not a game changer, but it certainly is a change in the right direction.
So I like those incentives for attracting foreign capital. We don't have a real problem in attracting foreign capital, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do we use those incentives for local development? Because there's local talent, there's local businesses here, there's local people with ideas here. But as we said, a huge part of that is the funding gap to say, I need 100 or 200,000 rand to start my business. And the bank's going to say, well, you're a high risk. We're not going to give you that money. Should we, and again, this is sparked by Sai and his ingenuity, not by me, just came to my mind as I looked at him and thought, Sai keeps mentioning the Saab premium. Remember the 3.5 or 350 basis points of premium that sits between what the Reserve Bank lends to the commercial banks and what the commercial banks then lend on to us? That premium there. Can we take 100 basis points out of that premium there, carve it out as a fund in itself, in that whatever we were going to make from that 100 basis points, or what banks were going to charge from a retail consumer perspective, can we do something from that perspective that would unlock some capital
and
or reduce the banking reserve? reserves because they're well capitalized.
And that's a cunning way of doing it. I mean, again, it goes back to most small businesses will fail. We need to be comfortable with that fact.
That's it.
And then there's other thing. I mean, part of it is money. Part of it is just resources, like an office, like you know, or a place to manufacture or something like that. It doesn't always need to be cold, hard cash. It can be, in the case of South 32, can just be cheap electricity, you know, or in the case of golfers, cheap land.
So in the case of something like special economic zones, perhaps we say that each company in South Africa that has a certain threshold of earnings or whatever in a year pays a 1% tax towards this particular fund or the transformation fund or whatever we want to call it, right? And that fund then goes around and intentionally builds artisans workshops. You build like a workshop studio. Anyone can come in there free of charge. It's got Wi-Fi, it's got internet connectivity, it's got machinery, it's got all those sorts of things, and people can come and learn a skill, people can come and develop a product, people can come and do those things. That kind of economic zone there, it won't create a job for you, but it'll allow you to acquire a skill that you can use somewhere else. Is that something that would benefit South Africans, or do we need more direct injection into the economy, and how do we attain that?
So, I mean, direct injection is great. I'm just not sure that depends who's injecting and how it's managed. Again, it's the risks of where does the money end up going. Direct injection, always a great thing. More money coming in is a good thing. Again, the risks associated, we get that. It comes back to who's doing it and who has the excess capital and the capacity to do it. If you remember the banks during the pandemic and they had all that, they had 200 billion of loans to give out and they just didn't give it out. Now, you know, partly it was people didn't apply, partly the banks just couldn't manage it, because what it was is that part of the default would be secured by the government. So in other words, you could lower your risk premiums or your risk profiles and it just didn't work.
So this brings up, as you mentioned the government side, brings up the conversation around whether or not we can spend our way out of this problem. So I think from a financing point of view, there is enough money in the South African ecosystem, whether it's private capital, public capital, businesses local, businesses offshore, whatever it is. I think there is enough money in the South African ecosystem to be able to help us meaningfully get back above 2, maybe even 3% GDP growth. Now, the deployment part is what's the frustration, I suppose. And I guess that's where we're trying to solve for that, is how do we deploy effectively and efficiently so that we can actually see this change?
And that is how that's just it, right? We unlock that, then the rest surely starts to happen as soon as we unlock the ability to do it. And we've had, you know, ministers for small business and,
Let's put it out there. Let's put it out to our community, because problem solving sometimes requires some help, and perhaps we can achieve this solution together. Give us your thoughts. If we were to say, for example, have 5 billion rand set aside by the government of South Africa to be matched by a 5 billion rand from the private sector or whatever it is. Let's say there's 10 billion rand out there that should be used to stimulate the South African economy such that we actually achieve tangible outcomes and results. We hold people accountable where people need to be held accountable, and we actually get economic growth back on track so that the people of the country can benefit. How do we do that? How do we get that done? Where do we put the money? What restrictions do we put on the money? And how do we achieve this together so that there's responsibility, accountability, growth, and meaningful impact?
Yeah.
That's it. That's our thought. We'd love to hear your comments around that. So drop us comments, drop us your suggestions in our communities, and we'll see if we can come back with some of those suggestions and see which of those suggestions make sense. But for now, that's where we're going to leave the deep dive. We're going to get into investor insights. We're going to look into some more peculiar developments in South Africa, and we're going to add an unfiltered opinion of the week. So stick around for that. And we wrap things up with our investor insights. We are diving into some ghost contracts that we found this time around. The Government Pensions Administrations Agency has agreed to pay just under a billion rand into what appears to be a fictitious agreement to lease a building for its headquarters in Pretoria for the next 10 years. Now, this is interesting because the GPAA administers the pension assets of government employees. So you're now dealing with pension money signing into this agreement. Apparently, the contract has some serious irregularities. The company that won the tender has no access to the building. So the building itself is owned by a listed company in the form of, I think it's Attack, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. It is based in Brooklyn. It's the Brooklyn Mall, owned by JSE listed Attack. And the company that has won the tender to provide the leasing service has no authority to lease out that building, it seems. And we're talking about R1 billion here over 10 years.
I got two thoughts. First was, I went in there, they had the actual the specs for the leasing. And I love the detail. Got to be 500 meters away from a public transport hub, et cetera, et cetera. But, gent, this is it's a ghost building for the ghost workers. Problem solved.
Quickest solution to everything.
It really is. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about a moment ago, rule of law. How hard is it to make sure that actually they own the building? I mean, just they own the building.
Due diligence when you award...
Like no one walked through the building?
Even if you didn't walk through it, I think if you're going through a tender process and you're saying, this is our preferred bidder to deliver this service.
Well, the documents required that you prove ownership.
That's it.
So they obviously...
You can't prove ownership. Proof that you have a lease agreement in place with Attack that affords you the ability to sublease, because that is the simple method here, right? So things that should be making sense don't really make sense, and you can't help but wonder, I mean, how does this all work? Because this isn't the only example of this sort of agreement in place, right? Last week...
It goes back. I mean, there was one that jumps to my mind. It was with Beckett Kale and a police building in Durban 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And here we are 15 years later.
Still nothing's happened, right? It's weird because...
And then the AG catches it, and the Attorney General jumps up and down and gets all upset.
And then nothing really happens, right? So how do you now deal with, I suppose this is an age-old problem we faced in South Africa, ghost employees, much less ghost contracts, the implications of those on the economy, on the ecosystem. I mean, there's other conversations that are happening at the moment around the IDT and irregular expenditure there relates to their CEO. Peter Louis Myberg's been following that up from the Daily Maverick's perspective. That speaks to a lot of challenges is the nicest word I could find to describe that in the South African economy, in how things are deployed, in those that are charged and tasked with doing the responsible thing on behalf of everybody else. Now, especially when you're dealing with pensioners' funds and you're dealing with government employees' monies, right? Mm. Surely there should be an added level of accountability around that.
Absolutely should. It's also important that we assume that this building is actually needed and, well, they're not going to get it because, well, oops.
Now, when they don't get it because, well, oops, and you find yourself in a situation like the Joburg Deeds Office that's still functioning quite difficultly because they haven't been able to work from their building because of occupational health and safety regulations. Mm-hmm. How long do these things go on for? How long do we let this thing happen, not fix the problem, have inefficient service delivery, and then come back and say, oh, but we couldn't deliver on our targets because we didn't have the service delivery in place? How does that make sense?
It doesn't. Comes back to accountability, Jen. I'm sounding like an old man shouting at the clouds. Sometimes I am an old man shouting at the clouds.
I can see you standing outside just going, why? And then walking back inside and finishing your coffee.
It happens.
Well, we don't have the answers, I guess. I mean, we've spoken about the answers, whether or not the answers are legitimately going to be put in place, going to be used. That, I suppose, remains a conversation for another day. But we are going to have to cut the show a little bit short. Before we do, we're going to have to leave you with an unfiltered opinion of the week because, well, we can't leave you without one. This week's unfiltered opinion is more of a question, a conundrum that perhaps we can all solve together. And it is this. What is it about golf that makes many rich people love playing it at some point in their life? Is golf a rich person's sport?
Isn't it, was that book, A Long Walk Spoiled?
A Long Walk Spoiled. Huh.
One of the golfers' biographies. I don't know the answer to it. I don't play golf because I'm not rich. I got a bad knee, a bad back, and an even worse hook. So...
It's all the running you used to do when you used to do the comrade side. So those golfers out there, please share your unfiltered opinion with us. What is it about the sport that attracts so many people, that has people willing to spend half a day on a golf course, if not a full day on a golf course, to hit a ball into a hole? Or why is it even called the toughest sport in the world? We'd love to hear your thoughts around that. And should we take up golf? Is it worthwhile? Is it something that has that much in it that... someone should perhaps say, hey, go become a golfer. That's the unfiltered opinion of the week. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it and your experiences around it as well. But until next time, investing isn't hard. Try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.